this week in the Inside Flap.
For one thing, I wasn't allowed in the creative writing program at the University of Arizona in 1964 because, as the professor told me, I was a girl. I was married to a man who was allowed in that program. He never published anything, but he told me in 1968, there's only going to be one writer in our family, and I'm it. Which is why I didn't actually start writing novels until I was a divorced single mother, two little kids, a full-time job selling life insurance, and the time I had to write was from 4 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock when I got the kids up to go to school and got me dressed to go to work.
Wow.
Does that sound like determination? And there was this couple standing in line, and they were just grinning at me, and I thought, okay, something's up here. And when they got to the head of the line, they said, are you aware that in this book, there's a character that you killed off in book number one?
The Inside Flap is available on demand every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com.
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to the show. Seated across the room, resting comfortably in bed, propped up by three pillows. Is it a three-pillow day?
It is,
three
yeah.
Pillows is Laura Medicus.
Laura. Howdy. Howdy.
How are you doing today? Thank you all for joining us. Welcome to the show. This is
The Inside Flap.
The Inside Flap Book Podcast Inside Chat Edition. We got a great guest for you today. We're joined by J.A. Jantz. We'll have that conversation for you in just a second. We had a great time talking to her, despite the fact that we had a little... It's always funny when you have little technical difficulties to begin an interview. The author always comes in a little frazzled, a little stressed out.
Yeah.
And I thought we were going to have a rough go of it for a second, but she's so great. And
she
it was
is
so
great.
Amazing to talk to. And she had so many just great stories. We didn't have, it was fantastic. We just kicked back and let her take over. So we'll have that conversation for you in just a second. We're sponsored today by IndieBound. Make sure you're supporting your local. It's so important now more than ever. To support local booksellers and IndieBound.org. It helps you do that. You can go to our website, theinsideflap.com, and click on the IndieBound link. That way, you are not only supporting independent booksellers, but you're also helping to support us. And it doesn't cost you a red cent or any other color of cent. At all.
Except for the price of the book.
Your purple cent. Wait, I should say a red cent. Extra. It doesn't cost you any extra.
That's the ticket.
As the cat rubs the... Now, I didn't know if you could catch that, but I heard the sound of static electricity as he walked across your mic. His tail sashayed across your microphone.
He's got a lot of electricity on him right now.
The sparks are flying here in the Inside Flap studio.
And we have a vintage metal bed.
Mm-hmm.
And at night, if I leave the bed to use the bathroom or get some water or wander the home,
for whatever reason,
thinking I hear somebody intruding, if I touch the end of the bed, sparks fly. Literally sparks fly in the dark. And it hurts. So every time I walk around the bed, I very carefully give it a wide berth.
People wondering and wandering. You think they wonder why we broadcast from the bedroom? It's kind of strange how we've just ended up here.
That's true.
You know, it's a nice room. It's a big room.
It's got a really big bedroom.
And
it's sunny.
Well, you know what? Because you had your desk in
here. Oh, I know why. We were in the basement, and then our teenage daughter decided needed to be in the basement to get as far away from us as possible.
It happened really organically. She just went one night. Started sleeping down there.
Well, it was when we had the asbestos taken off
because
she had school that day and it was just so loud.
It was loud. So she moved down there and she's been there ever since.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, welcome to the show. Laura, how are things by you?
Yeah, things are good. I had a birthday on Thursday.
Woo!
Yeah.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
Yes.
And it's when you are over the age of 40.
Mm-hmm.
birthdays aren't, I don't know. It's almost like at a certain point when you're a kid, Christmas is amazing.
Yeah.
And then you get a little bit older and it just starts to become really wonderful, but not as like magical as it once was.
Right. And you kind of see it once you, and then when you have kids, it becomes
magical again.
You see it, but only through their eyes.
Yes.
Exactly.
It does become magical again. Mm-hmm. And then again, once they become a teenager, they stop believing in
right.
Santa then, Claus and stuff like that.
The magic, it dissipates. It,
but it's still a nice time. So I'm not trying to say that my birthday is not nice, but it's no longer, it hasn't been magical. It hasn't been special for a while, like for years now.
Well, and it's nothing like it is when you're a kid. I mean, my students, I remember, and this, here's another sad thing. I didn't even think about this, but this is another sad part of not being, having in school person, or what am I trying to say? Not being in person in school, which as over 60% of my kids don't come in, and, you know, half the kids only come a couple of days, whatever. But if you on a normal school year, you any day of the year, you'd walk down the hallway and you'd see, you know, from halfway down
the lockers.
The hall, no, you could see a huge, a floating flotilla of balloons cascading down the hallway as, you know, when it's their birthday, kids come in and they give balloons and big stuffed animals.
Yeah.
And sometimes if it's a girl, she'll wear a, or a guy, anybody, you know,
a
let's
crown?
Not assign gender. They'll wear little tiaras.
Oh,
little,
really?
All kinds of stuff. Huh. Yeah. So it is very, very special.
Yeah.
More so than I've ever seen it than it is at the school that I'm at right now, where kids make a big deal of it. And it's a lot of fun. And lockers get decorated, yes, but it's the floating parade of balloons.
Yeah,
you
I don't
can
know.
See the balloons from
are
everywhere.
They, is it maybe quinceañeras that are being celebrated?
No, no. Well,
no.
Well, no, that's a different thing, but I think it all ties into it. But certainly birthdays are celebrated with aplomb.
I mean, I definitely have enjoyed my birthday through the years, but really, I mean, maybe it was 35 and older, but I'm going to say probably 40 and older.
No.
It has stopped
everything,
meaning much of anything to me, and I'll work the day. But then I also, I don't mind working the day. I like my job. I mean, you know, work for myself, so I'm certainly not going to, you know.
Not going to call in
I'm
sick.
Not going to just take a day with no money just so I can
doesn't make any
sit.
Sense.
Look, and my birthday's in February, and it's been miserably
right.
cold.
Yeah,
and now
ski.
There's a pandemic. So there's not like, oh, I'm going to take myself to a movie or, oh, I'm going to sit outside today and do some gardening and enjoy myself. So there's none of that going on.
Yeah, it reached the point for me when I got a little older where saying you're going to take the day off.
It's embarrassing.
It is embarrassing. That's exactly right. You reach a certain age where it's like you're 44
the
years old,
is,
guy. Why are you taking the day off to celebrate
your birthday?
I feel
like I would
really?
If my birthday were in May or June.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would, but because I am saddled with a February birthday, we live in Colorado.
Right.
I guess if we lived in a warmer climate,
if you skied, you could take the day out to go skiing.
I could.
You know,
that's true. If I skied, thank
you,
Dave.
Skied.
If I skied,
I'm just saying we do live in a great winter.
We do. We do. Yeah.
For
never did. I am past the age of being able to learn
world class
how to downhill
resorts.
Ski. So,
right, yeah.
But if I did know
if
how
you
to
did,
ski,
yeah.
That would be something.
I always like to go for a long run on my birthday. I like to find a mountain to tackle.
It was maybe a high of 32 with like 6 inches of snow on my birthday.
No, no good. No
and
good.
But it's one of those things too where I will forget and then I'll think, oh, it's my birthday. I should do something nice for myself. And so then I start to get a little resentful. But then, and then it's like, what's wrong with you?
Woo! Hey, it's your birthday. You're 40-some years old. You can't even remember how old you are.
That is
Let's
true.
Celebrate. Woo! How old am I? I don't know. Let me do some math. What year was I born? I remember when I had to start doing that in my 40s.
Well,
you had to figure out what year you were born to remember how old you are.
Ever since I've been 35, I also will take that age and then 6 months before I turn the next age
I start
telling myself in my head, well, you're this age now, just to get used to it, you know, just to amp up to it. And then by the time
that
birthday comes around,
that was your last birthday,
thank you. And then by the time the birthday comes around, I'll think, well, now I'm turning this next age. But it's like because I just fool myself, which is silly. It's all silly,
it's
Dave.
It's trickery.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what's not trickery is J.A. Jantz's new book. Missing and Endangered. Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about this book so we can give the people what they want, some J.A. Jantz.
Mm-hmm. So I'm actually going to tell you something noteworthy and remarkable about this author first.
Okay.
So this is her 19th Joanna Brady book. Mm. She's written 24 J.P. Beaumont books.
Yeah, boy!
15 Allie Reynolds books with another one coming out soon.
Uh-huh.
Which she happily told us, and 5 Walker family books.
Mm. That's a bingo.
So I'm running out of drops to celebrate her
okay.
with.
J.A. Jantz is a writing queen.
She is a writing queen.
I mean, that is truly remarkable and noteworthy.
It's
it really is.
A testament. The fact that also that she's as popular now as she ever was, that's just a testament to her longevity and her writing prowess.
Yeah, so this book revolves around Sheriff Joanna Brady's college-age daughter, Jennifer,
mm-hmm.
and her roommate, Beth, as well as a domestic violence case that is in Brady's area.
Mm.
And Sheriff Brady is the sheriff in Cochise County, Arizona. She's out of Bisbee, Arizona, which
Bisbee.
I did not know where that was. If you look at a map, it looks quite lovely. It is south of Tombstone, Arizona,
uh-huh.
which is they're all southeast of Tucson.
Yeah, I just remembered. That's the name of the coffee shop that my parents go to that they've been going to weekly every time they tell me they've been at Bisbee's. Yeah.
Now, David.
There's my mom.
And yeah, hello.
There's my dad. They
Bisbee,
tell me
Arizona.
All throughout this pandemic, they've been going there weekly. And every time, yeah, we're over here at Bisbee's. And I just shake. Thank God. Now they're vaccinated. We can all laugh about it now.
That's
sure.
True.
But
we can.
Every week they would my mom would do the crossword. Oh, my goodness.
Oh,
at
wow.
the Bisbee's. Yeah,
really?
Every week. When the cleaning lady would come to their house, they'd go to Bisbee's.
That's funny. Well, yeah, so Bisbee's a little town kind of down near the Mexico border.
Mm-hmm.
So Jennifer's roommate is in an online romance that goes horribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And Joanna Brady is dealing with a deputy that was shot during a domestic violence phone call.
Mm.
The deputy, unfortunately, also shot and killed the suspect. So, you know, all eyes are on this case whenever that something like that happens. So this is a police procedural. Jantz is a professional. She knows how to tell a story. You don't write 65 books
no, you don't.
Without knowing how to get it done.
That's right.
And Joanna Brady, the character, is a straightforward, hardworking, caring protagonist who I find very likable.
Mm-hmm. All right. And you are in for a treat. Here she is. J.A. Jantz.
It never crossed her mind. There is no Arizona, no painted desert.
No, by the way, it's gorgeous.
That is a Tuscany scene by a painter from Sedona named M.L. Coleman. His paintings are all over our house.
Ooh, oh, lucky you. Wow. Look at that. Oh, gosh, those are gorgeous.
It's a way of bringing a piece of Arizona. And that wall over there is actually sort of our travel. Our travel scrapbook.
That's nice. So you're not in Arizona right now? Are you in Arizona?
I am not in Arizona right now. Oh. I'm in Seattle where it snowed like crazy over the weekend.
Oh.
Yeah, we got some snow here. We're in Colorado, got some snow overnight. But my sister lives in Tucson. I think you have a place in Tucson, yeah.
Well, we used to have a place in Tucson. We sold it a year and a half ago, and it's a good thing because getting back and forth to it in the face of the pandemic would have been impossible.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I loved Missing and Endangered. Absolutely loved it. Your latest book about Sheriff Joanna Brady.
Mm-hmm.
Number 19 in that series. And I believe this is your 65th book.
Hey, give it up. Woo!
That is amazing.
Well, I am 76 at this moment. I started writing when I was 38 years old. And so I've been writing at
a
rate of about 1.67 books a year ever since.
Wow.
Early on, I was interviewed by a young reporter, and she asked me how old I was when I started writing, and I told her I was 38. And she said, "Oh, you were so old." And I thought, well, she ought to see how old I am now.
That is remarkable. I was wondering what your output was. I could have done the math, but that is really impressive.
That is very impressive.
Well, since 2003, I've done 2 books a year and 2 book tours a year up until last year. And a book tour, a regular in-person book tour, removes about a month from your life. And so on the one hand, doing a virtual book tour is certainly easier on the body, but I really miss the interactions with fans. Yeah. That's something that I really value.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
it's tough.
So I'm missing that, but I do. I read all my emails. Emails from fans are my bread and butter. Those people are my people. And so I respond to every email personally.
Wow.
Excuse me. Because it's important.
Yeah.
That's very time consuming. That I imagine. I still don't know how you are writing 1.67 books. Going on book tours. I mean, you've had children. You've had children and grandchildren. I mean, it's not like you're a solitary woman.
Right. Staying busy.
Well, someone asked me a week or so ago, what word would I use to describe myself? And I would say that word is determined. Hmm. I was determined to be a writer from the time I was in second grade. There were a lot of stumbling blocks. For one thing, I wasn't allowed in the creative writing program at the University of Arizona in 1964 because, as the professor told me, I was a girl. Wow. I was married to a man who was allowed in that program. He never published anything, but he told me in 1968, there's only going to be one writer in our family, and I'm it. Which is why I didn't actually start writing novels until I was a divorced single mother,
wow,
2 little kids, a full-time job selling life insurance. Wow. And the time I had to write was from 4 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock when I got the kids up to go to school and got me dressed to go to work.
Wow.
Does that sound like determination?
That's the definition of determination. That is absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
When people tell me, oh, someday when my life is perfect,
yeah,
I'm going to be a writer too. And I always feel like saying, like hell you will. Because if you wait until your life is perfect, you'll never write.
No. Uh-uh.
And some of the things I use for backgrounds in my stories are the imperfections of life. Mm. My first husband died of chronic alcoholism at age 42, a year and a half after I divorced him. Now, you have to work really hard to die of booze at that age.
Yeah.
Most of the time, it takes several decades longer than that. But it was something he was really good at.
He was determined and as well. So yeah.
When I created my first fictional character, J.P. Beaumont is my literary firstborn. His books are told in the first person, and I couldn't have him working all the time. So when he wasn't working, he did the kind of drinking I had lived with for 18 years of my life. Mm-hmm. 4 books in, people started asking me, you know, I think J.P. Beaumont has a problem. He drinks every day. He has a drink of choice. It's starting to interfere with his work.
Yeah.
And I say, you know, these are books. But 6 different people asked that same question. And I thought, you know, alcoholism is a disease of denial. No wonder I didn't figure it out. So that part of my background got written into the books. I wrote 9 Beaumont books in a row, and I was getting really tired of him. I could never have been Sue Grafton and written all of those books about one character in a row. That just
doesn't interest you.
I'm so sorry she didn't get beyond why, but I could never have launched off on that kind of a project. So when I threatened to kill Beaumont off, my editor said, well, why don't you come up with a different character and we can sort of alternate? Well, Beaumont, when I started writing about him, was a middle-aged male Seattle homicide cop. He was a Seattle native. So when I started writing about him, I had never been in law enforcement. I didn't even know for a couple of books that what I was writing was police procedural. Somebody had to tell me that. I had never been a cop. I had lived in Seattle less than 2 years. And writing that first person narrative requires a real discipline, because the only things the readers can learn are what J.P. Beaumont sees, hears, says, does, or thinks. And so, and writing the male point of view, all those years I was married to my first husband, I tried to figure out what made the guys at the bars so much more interesting to him than I was. So I went to the bars with him and I listened to how those guys talked and I tried to understand what made them tick. And when it was time to write Beaumont, I just sent my head back to all those bars and started writing.
Well, something good came out of it then. There you go.
Exactly. In terms of being husband material, my first husband was a dead loss. But from the point of view of a mystery writer, the guy was a gold mine.
Gold, gold, absolute gold.
But now I had the prospect of writing a new series. So I thought, well, how about if I press the easy button here and don't make it first person?
Yeah.
Okay. Third person will give me a lot more flexibility.
Yeah.
And how about if instead of using a male protagonist, I use a female protagonist, since I know more about that than I do about the other.
Yeah.
And I actually thought that Joanna was going to end up being an amateur sleuth. Of course, that went sideways later on. But I thought, okay, I didn't know anything about Seattle when I started writing about it. I know a lot about Arizona, so why don't I have female protagonist and an Arizona setting? So I set out to write that first scene. And that's how books come to me. They do not come to me in this whole package. I have to start out at the beginning and write to the end. I don't outline books. I follow the story and the characters as the story unfolds. I've been told that that means I'm an organic writer. I guess that means I don't use hormones while I'm writing hormones for antibiotics.
You're non-GMO.
Yes.
But I sat down to write that first scene. And there is Joanna at home with her mother and her 9-year-old daughter. Her mother, Eleanor, is there to take care of Jenny while Joanna and her husband, Andy, go out for their 10th anniversary celebration. Jenny is 9. She's just had a little bit of sex ed at Greenway School. And she's bright, and she's just counted on her fingers and figured out that there aren't quite enough months between her 9th birthday and that 10th anniversary.
Oh. Well,
she could just as well have exploded a nuclear bomb in the room.
Yeah.
Because, of course, she wasn't early. What was late was the wedding.
Oh, yeah.
And Eleanor, Joanna's mother, has been on a tear about that ever since Joanna got pregnant while she was still in high school at age 17.
Wow.
So there it was. Well, the reason Andy was late coming home for dinner, to go to dinner, was he was lying bleeding out of the end of the driveway because he had been gunned down by a hitman inadvertently. again, without realizing, I wrote some of my own story into that story because I was the last parent standing in my family. And suddenly Joanna Brady was the last parent standing in her family. But there was another layer to that because Eleanor had been the last parent standing in hers. And of course, that whole conversation set the tone for this tug of war between Joanna and her mother that carries on right through Eleanor's eventual death 18 books later. So it's interesting to me to see in retrospect how my own history has evolved into the background of my stories.
How do you, well, I don't want to give anything away, but I do like where I think you might be going with Jenny in this book. At the, you know, we have Jenny is now in college. She may or may not have chosen a different career path. And I find it really interesting. And she's well, like,
that's one of the advantages of writing a series, because I started writing the Joanna Brady books in the early 90s. And so these characters have evolved. Only 12 years have taken place in the course of the book, but 30 years have passed in real life. And in a series, you have time to watch those characters evolve and change in a way you don't have the opportunity to do in a one book. We've seen Jenny growing up. We've seen her get her first horse, become a barrel racer. Now she's attending college on a rodeo scholarship. And she's become a resourceful, capable young woman. And somebody wrote to me and said, I'm only two chapters in, but I feel like I'm settling in with old friends.
That's great. What a compliment.
But that's sort of how I feel when I start writing a book. It's turning to those characters and saying, hey, you guys, it's me. What have you been up to while my back is turned? And that's
cool.
That's something that readers don't maybe understand, because characters do things while the author isn't working. In Skeleton Canyon, Joanna Brady, number 5, she is driving the medical examiner home from a crime scene. And on the way, he drops another bomb and lets her know that he and Joanna's mother just eloped, and Joanna almost wrecked the car. And I almost wrecked my computer because it was a big surprise to me as well.
Oh, that's wild. That is so wild. Do you have notes or any, do you have to go back and look at your books to remember? Because you have a lot of coworkers and other people in Joanna Brady's life also.
I keep a name file. I didn't used to. I used to keep everything in my head.
Oh.
And then one day I was doing a signing, and there was this couple standing in line, and they were just grinning at me. And I thought, okay, something's up here. And when they got to the head of the line, they said, are you aware that in this book, there's a character that you killed off in book number 1?
Whoa.
I looked at Desert Heat, and they were absolutely right. So I painted my way out of that corner by having the guy in this book be the namesake nephew of the previous character.
Good for you. Good for you. That's right.
So I keep a name file. Joanna Brady's height has varied a little bit, so I try to keep track of how tall they are.
It's an awful lot to keep track of.
Hair color, background information. That's the thing. You have to know everything about a character even if it doesn't show up on the page.
Right.
Yeah.
In the Beaumont book I'm reading right now, it is dealing with the children of a character who died in a domestic violence incident in Beaumont number 14.
Wow.
And so they were just these two kids were just little boys when their mother died. And now they're grown up. But now I've had to go back, and the tough part about this book is recreating all the history that I didn't put in that first book. And I should have put all the history in to begin with. But I do keep a name file for each series. So I know who's who, what kind of weapons they carry, what kind of cars they drive, and all of that stuff.
Yeah, because your readers will probably tell you.
Right.
Well, they do notice. In Beaumont number 24, a book called Second Watch, I came up with a brainy idea. The way I remember Beau's birthday is he and I had the same birthday.
There you go.
That helped me remember.
That's funny.
So I came up with a brainstorm of having Beau's fictional life intertwine with that of a guy I knew in Bisbee High School. Wow. Doug Davis was a year ahead of me in school. He was whip smart. He was an outstanding athlete. He was handsome. He was kind. He was the it guy. And after graduating from Bisbee High School, he went to West Point. After West Point, he went to Ranger School. And from there, he went to Vietnam, where he died weeks before his 23rd birthday. Mm. At Thanksgiving, the year before, one of my sons looked at me as only a 40-something son can and said, "You know, Mom, Beaumont is getting pretty long of tooth. Have you ever thought of writing a Beaumont prequel?" And I gave him sort of this glacial stare, and I said, "No, Tom, I have never thought of writing a Beaumont prequel. But in August of the following year, when it was time to write that book, I was thinking about my birthday and how old Beau was. Mm. And then I thought about Doug Davis and how old he would have been. He would have been a year ahead of Beau. Mm. And I thought, what would happen if Beau and Doug Davis interacted in Vietnam?
Wow.
So over the years, I had become acquainted with Bonnie Abney, the woman who was engaged to marry Doug at the time of his death. She and I had become friends. So I called her and I said, I laid out the idea. And she said, "Well, let me think about it for a couple of days." The truth is, at that point, Doug's mother was dead. His brother was dead. And there was nobody else to ask but Bonnie. And a few days later, she called me back and she said, "I think my Douglas would be safe in your hands." And so I wrote that book. And that book came out and I wrote it in about 3 months from beginning to end. It was a magical book to write. And in the book, when Beaumont is the age he was then, and it starts with him undergoing bilateral knee replacement. And while he's in his hospital rooms under the influence of drugs, he has this very vivid dream. When my husband had his bilateral knee replacement, he had drugs too. And he had very vivid dreams. And that was sort of the spark.
Yeah.
So Beau wakes up and there's this guy standing in his hospital room looking out the window at the Space Needle. Now, Beau should have understood immediately that this was wrong, since the window he was looking at the Space Needle from is on the wrong side of the hospital. But the guy was wearing a pair of Vietnam-era fatigues. And he turns away from the window and he comes sauntering over to Bo's bed. And Bo recognizes it's his commanding officer from Vietnam. Mm. And Doug comes up to Bo's dead and says, "You got old." Mm. And of course, that's Bo's whole problem with Doug. Yeah. He came home and got old, and Doug didn't. Wow. So in the course of the book, Bo finally, after all those years, seeks out Bonnie Abney and tells her how sorry he was. And the response to that book has been incredible. I hear from, not a week goes by that I don't hear from a Vietnam vet who has just read that book. Excuse me. But my idea in writing that book was to make two people from that era, one of those names chiseled into that wall in Washington, come through as people. I didn't attend Doug's funeral when it happened because I was in Las Vegas that summer and didn't hear about it until after it was already over. I always felt guilty about not attending. And writing that book in a way seemed like a kind of reparation for missing it. On the anniversary of Doug's 50th, the 50th anniversary of Doug's death, Bonnie went to Bisbee. She went to Evergreen Cemetery. She spent most of the day at Doug's graveside that day. But what she discovered was that people who had read the book had found their way to Bisbee and to the cemetery and had left behind tokens, mementos of tokens of their esteem. And so I made that happen. Doug's loss has not been forgotten.
Wow.
And I no longer have to feel guilty about not attending his funeral. But here's something. I'm always surprised when I'm out signing books and somebody will come meandering past the table. Well, I'll say, would you like to have a mystery? And they'll say, "Oh, I don't read mysteries." And and the way they say it, you know,
they
feel like mysteries are just too
beneath them.
Well, pointless to bother reading. And their time is too important to spend on something frivolous like reading a mystery. But I put real stuff in my mysteries. Mm-hmm. In Missing and Endangered, that's going to be a real eye opener to a lot of grandparents who have no idea the kind of cyber criminals who are waiting out there online, ready to pounce on their unsuspecting grandkids, grandsons and granddaughters both. I put real stuff in my books, and I always get even with the people who say, "Oh, I don't read murder mysteries," because I sold life insurance for 10 years. And in the life insurance business, you're taught to take 10 no's and get the appointment. And then at the appointment, you're taught to take 10 no's and walk away with an application and the check. And so those people almost always walk away with an autographed murder mystery, which they're going to go buy because they have someone in their family who reads murder mysteries.
Oh, there you go.
I do have my ways of getting even with those folks.
Wow. It goes back to your determination, right?
Well, also, yes. And your books are, you can go to Costco and find a J.A. Jantz book.
Yes. They're everywhere.
It's out there. Yeah.
Costco did a big buy of Missing and Endangered. And right now, for all too many people, going to Costco every 2 weeks is their only social outlet.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. I love this book. I had not heard of sextortion before, which is something that Beth Rankin, Jenny's roommate, deals with. I didn't know that the FBI would get involved in stuff like that. I'm happy to hear it. Mm-hmm. Did you do research on that? I'm assuming you did.
Well, here's what I've never been a cop. So one of my major forms of research is watching crime, true crime cases on TV. And it was watching a series on ID Discovery called Web of Lies, where I first encountered sextortion. It was a young woman in Arizona, in Scottsdale, I believe, who became involved in an online relationship with a guy she thought was a couple of years older than she was. In actual fact, he was a middle-aged predator. And he encouraged her to take selfies, nude selfies, and send them to him. And when she tried to break off the relationship, he threatened to make them public, put them up on the net. And she was so distraught, she actually considered suicide before she finally alerted her mother. And the mother involved the police, and they eventually caught the guy. But that was the spark for this book. When I saw that show, did I think it was going to be one of my books? No, I didn't think that. What happens to me is my second husband, the good one, claims that I have a whirring blender in my head. And stuff comes into my head from wherever it comes. And it goes through this process. And then when it comes leaking out through my fingertips, however many years later, the story is sort of there, but it's changed. And I can give you a very real example. In the early 60s, my older sister and her husband had this little ranchette outside of Bisbee. And they had a horse named Warpaint, a cow named Shirley, a pig named Oscar, and an Australian Shepherd named Smokey Joe. Well, Warpaint was the brains of the outfit. And he knew that if it rained, the electric fence would stop working and he could let everybody out. And he did. So one day my sister came home from work and it had rained, so everybody was out. Smokey Joe could be counted on to round up Shirley and the pig. But once Warpaint was out in the pasture, he was out in the pasture.
Yeah.
And he was fine. You could walk up to him as long as you had nothing in your hands. But if you had anything that resembled a rope or a bridle, he would stay just out of reach. So my sister walked up to Warpaint carrying nothing. She snuggled up under his neck and was just sort of petting him. And then she reached up under her shirt, hauled off her bra, wrapped it around his neck, and led him home. Poor Warpaint. He never knew what hit him.
No.
Years later, decades later, I'm writing Skeleton Canyon, Joanna Brady number 5.
Yeah.
And Joanna is pinned down by gunfire out in the middle of nowhere. She needs to have a diversion, so she whips off her bra and uses it as a slingshot. Now, I cannot explain how my sister's bra in Bisbee became Joanna's bra in Skeleton Canyon, but it has something to do with the whirling blender.
The whirling blender gets them every time.
That's awesome.
So when something like that happens, do you contact your sister and say, hey, thanks for that bra story?
Yes, thanks for the idea.
All right. Listen, J.A. Jantz, thank you so much for spending some time with us. It's been an absolute delight. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you. And I have a new Allie Reynolds book coming in June. So stay tuned.
All right. Very much.
It's called Unfinished Business.
Oh, we'll look for it. That's awesome.
I love that title. And we loved Missing and Endangered. Thank you.
The Inside Club.
All right, there you go. Thank you so much to J.A. Jantz. Fantastic conversation. Thanks so much to her. My name is Dave Medicus. We'll see you next week.
Adios.
My second husband, the good one.